You know, I kind of like this dual speaker format. Reminds me of the olden days when we go to the movies and we get the double feature. So as has been announced, Kenny is the feature presentation, so you know what that makes me, the cartoon. In preparing for tonight, one thing I discovered, it's really hard to prepare a 15-minute lesson. So what I did was I took a sermon I did a few years back and pared it down a little bit. And I thought tonight we'd talk a little bit about money management. And with the economy being such a topic of interest right now, I think this is something that would be profitable for all of us to remind ourselves of. You know, the Bible is just full of wisdom for everyday living. And sound fiscal policy is no exception. So tonight what we're going to do is look at seven tips for managing money from the book of Proverbs. And the first passage that we'll look at tonight, our first financial tip, is Proverbs chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. And the passage reads, "Honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase, so your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine." The verse here is concerned with two priorities. First of all, remembering who God is by honoring the Lord. And secondly, giving with our first fruits. Paul reminds us in 1 Timothy verses 6 and 7 that we brought nothing into this world. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 7, he states that whatever is in our hands now was received from someone else. I think Solomon obviously realized that everything we have is God's, and we're just stewards or managers of God's possessions. And therefore, we need to give or use what we're blessed with to honor God. Second financial tip, Proverbs chapter 10, verse 4. "He who deals with a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes one rich." We've seen this word slack before, haven't we? Now, the Lord is not slack concerning his promises. It means to be slow or to be sluggish or negligent or to lack energy. And stewardship is more than just giving. It also demands working. There are some people that are poor due to circumstances that are beyond their control, but there are other people out there who are just plain lazy. And Solomon warned in the 24th chapter that poverty will come like a prowler. Laziness is a spiritual matter, whether we're applying it to handling money or any other aspect of life. And that's why Paul said in Romans chapter 12, verse 1, that we should not be lagging in diligence, but fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. And in Colossians chapter 3, verse 23, he put work in its divine perspective when he wrote, "And whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men." Tip number three. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 11. "Wealth gained by dishonesty will be diminished, but he who gathers by labor will increase." You know, anything that's worth having is worth working for. And a person who works for what he obtains is likely to appreciate the value of a dollar. But, you know, people today get lured into all these get-rich schemes and into shady business practices and into uncontrollable gambling. They're looking for that easy wealth. There's so many books out there, television shows, radio shows that are designed to help people make the fast buck. But a hard day's work never hurt anyone. And actually, it's an essential part of having job satisfaction, I believe. That is, being able to go home at the end of the day and say to yourself, you know, I really earned my paycheck today. People who think that money grows on trees are going to spend it quickly. And those who work hard to obtain it will know how they got what they have, and they'll be more likely to retain their earnings. Tip number four, Proverbs chapter 15, verse 27. "He who is greedy for gain troubles his own house, but he who hates bribes will live." Honesty is always the best policy, and we all know that there's a lot of illegal money to be made out there. Despite the expression, crime does pay sometimes, at least for a little while. Often, however, it's the thief's family that pays and pays and pays. Dishonesty can have a devastating effect on the family. The man who cheats on his income tax or borrows government or company equipment or embezzles from the PTA or from the soccer league is doing a whole lot more than just shorting his employer. He's robbing his children of the most important moral influence in their lives. And that's the example of an honest father. Tip number five, Proverbs 17, verse 1. Better is a dry morsel with quietness than a house full of feasting with strife. I think the idea here is that no amount of money can replace peace and love in our home. And really, how much would you be willing to sell your family for? Many parents that might be insulted by such a question neglect their family in a quest for financial security. How much is a bigger house or a new car really worth if in acquiring it, the possessions we lose our children? Tip number six, Proverbs 19, verse 17. He who has pity on the poor lends to the Lord, and he will pay back what he has given. Maybe this passage warrants a little more discussion because I think many of us can tend to be selfish at times with our money, particularly when times are tight. You know, there's a lot of debate in our country right now about government entitlement programs. And while I don't believe in continuing to fund lazy people that I spoke of earlier, who aren't trying to help themselves, I certainly believe that there needs to be a safety net for people that are truly in dire straits. But even within the church, there is debate at times about who can be helped with funds from the treasury and who are the needy indeed. Well, all that being said, one thing is for sure. If the government or the church is not helping the needy, then we as individuals need to pick up the slack, and we're commanded to do so. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those of the household of faith. Galatians chapter 6. Solomon warned in Proverbs chapter 22 that he who oppresses the poor will answer to God. You know, when we share with those that are in need, it's more than charity. It's actually smart finances. It's not throwing our money away. It's investing in eternity. And God has promised this. In Proverbs 28:27, he says, "Give to the poor and you will never be in need." So generosity is just simply a matter of faith. And James said that faith without works is dead. In Luke 14, verses 12 through 14, Jesus showed that serving the poor is a good investment and it is an act of faith. And the passage there reads, "And he went on to say to the one who had invited him, 'When you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and repayment come to you. But when you give a reception, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, since they do not have the means to repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous.'" In 1 John chapter 3, the writer shows us that giving to others is a demonstration of our love for God. But whoever has the world's goods and beholds his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. And in the next chapter of 1 John, we're told that we cannot say that we love God, but hate our brother. The one who loves God should love his brother also. And then the last tip for the evening is out of Proverbs chapter 22, verse 7. It reads, "The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender." And as Gene says, this is where I stop preaching and start meddling, probably because it's also where I start stepping on my own toes. There are certainly times when it is appropriate to use credit. Things happen. We lose our jobs, our car breaks down, our washing machine quits working. But the improper use of credit has spelled disaster for many families, and it can actually lead to the downfall of our nation. Personal debt in the United States is increasing at a rate of $1,000 per second. And last night I did a little internet search and I found on cardweb.com where they estimated that the average credit card balance for families with one credit card is $10,700. So I think it should be an urgent goal of all Christian families to get out of debt as soon as possible. Every attempt should be made to avoid the credit traps that rob us of our financial freedom. And there's good reason for that, because if we don't, we become enslaved to the lender. And as a result, God ends up getting our leftovers or nothing at all. And think for a minute. Have you ever considered how effective you would be if you tried to convert someone that you owed money to, particularly if you were behind in your payments? So I think we all need to try maybe cutting up the credit cards or hiding them at least for a while and see what happens, and be patient and save up for the things that we really need first, and then save the luxury items that we think are essential for later on. All right, so there you have it. Free advice from the number one top financial advisor in the world. And, you know, one thing Solomon did not promise us, he didn't promise us that his wise words were going to make us rich as he was. But what he did say is that his proverbs were designed to make his readers honest and just and fair. And as I was preparing this lesson, I couldn't help but think about the song that we sing, "What Shall It Profit a Man?" And verse 3 reads, "This solemn question answer is worldly gain thy goal? Can fleeting riches be compared to an immortal soul?" And the chorus says, "What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" Solomon's rare wisdom concerning finances, among other things, is priceless beyond measure. And his advice guides us to invest heart and treasure where they both belong, and that's in eternity.
I don't know if I would be the main feature and the double feature here, but thank you, Richard, for that. I think Richard did a great job, and you should have actually did that one a couple more years way back when I was in credit card trouble. Needless to say, I had a lovely wife that told me to cut them up and helped me get out of that. So many thanks to her, but that was a wonderful lesson. It is difficult to put together a sermon. I've tried in the past, and I've brought some lessons in the past, and just I try to make things, make what I'm going to speak about personal from my point of view. As one, someone had told me a long time ago when I was doing my martial arts things, they said, "You can't lead somebody where you've never been." So everything that I talk about is something from a road that I've traveled. And tonight my lesson is going to be on challenges. And the reason I speak of challenges, because I don't know if many know, some may, but I have and suffer from depression a lot of times, and that feeds in on upon of itself. For anyone that knows or goes through depression, you understand that it can be very devastating to your life. It makes you feel less of a person, makes you isolated, alienated, even though you may not be. And I struggle with that all my days. So looking at that perspective, I figured we'd talk about challenges. And I want to look at two examples in the scriptures of past challenges. And then our final scripture that I'm going to look at is a current and present challenge to us all. So what I'd like to do is talk about Moses. And I'm not going to read about the whole story of Moses. I'm pretty sure everyone's kind of familiar. But Moses was tending his sheep, and all of a sudden he was up in the mountains, and there was this burning bush out there. You know, to me, I would have just fallen on the ground. I mean, seeing a burning bush that was actually talking to me. Okay, now, a burning bush in and of itself, you might want to try to go put out. But this bush was talking to Moses. That would have kind of floored me. You know, I got to kind of look back and going, how would I have accepted that? Well, God, through talking to Moses, he's commanded Moses to go and lead the children of Israel out of the bondage of Egypt. Now, think about that challenge there for a minute. That's a pretty heavy task. Moses, we all know Moses had fled from Egypt, and, you know, he was brought up, as, you know, in Pharaoh's house and all that, but he was now basically a herder. And I got to put that in myself. Someone asked me to go, hey, I need you to go down here and liberate these people. I don't know if I could do that. But Moses was up to the challenge. And what I like to do is I want to read from Exodus 4, 1 through 12, through some of these things here. And I'll talk about some of the challenges Moses faced that we can apply to our everyday lives. In Exodus 4, starting in verse 1. So then Moses answered and said, but suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say, the Lord has not appeared unto you. So the Lord said unto him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a rod. And he said, cast it down on the ground. So he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. Then the Lord said to Moses, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. And he reached out his hand and he caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord of their fathers, the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob has appeared unto you. Furthermore, the Lord said unto him, now put your hand into your bosom. And then he put his hand into his bosom. And when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous, like snow. And he said, put your hand in your bosom again. So he put his hand into his bosom again and drew it out, and behold, it was restored like his other flesh. Then it will be, if they do not believe you or heed the message on the first sign, they may believe the message on the latter sign. And it shall be, if they do not believe even those two signs or listen to your voice, that you shall take water from the river and pour it on the dry ground, that the water you take from the river will become blood on the dry land. Then Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I'm not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. So the Lord said unto him, who has made man's mouth? Or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be your mouth and teach you what you shall say. I'm going to stop there because we all know Moses kind of kept on protesting there a little bit. But Lord. And so finally the Lord got Aaron to be his mouthpiece. But I wanted to look at that few scriptures there. What kind of challenges do we see that Moses may have faced here? One of the challenges he would have is being believed. He said, well, what if they don't believe me? People listening. Now, we don't have that fear when you're asked to go out and preach the word or teach the word. Even if you're not a gospel preacher, people don't want to listen to you. And to me, that's a big fear. And then the fear of speaking. Now, sometimes I can drone on and I can speak, but I've always been afraid to speak. And I hate talking on the telephone. Don't ever call me and expect to have more than a 5-minute conversation with me on the phone, because I run out of things to say on the phone. But these are some of the things that Moses faced. Do we allow these things to affect us today? Think about it on a personal level. I know I do. Not just in spreading the word of God, but just through everyday life. I fear of people believing me, understanding what I'm trying to say to them, people actually listening. And then sometimes I fear that I'm not going to say the right thing, because sometimes my mind goes a little bit faster than my mouth does, and I'm already about 2 steps ahead, and then what's coming out my mouth ain't what's in my mind. So let's think about that. My next example I want to go through is the 12 spies of Canaan. And we, most of us, are pretty familiar with that. They had already been liberated from Egypt, and they've not yet gone through the wandering in the desert yet. But they were being led. God had promised them this promised land. And in context, when you think about just the 12 spies, they were weeded out through a process of hundreds of men that had volunteered. So think about it. These were people who were willing to go out, and they were even weeded out. So I would say these are the best of the best of the best, in essence. God had chosen these men. And they went out and they spied the land of Canaan. They saw the lands full of, they were fertile. And as the scripture says, flowing with milk and honey. But then again, they saw the giants. They saw the Hittites, I think it was the Amorite. I can't remember exactly which ones, but there was a bunch of different enemies they found in this land. And I want to read a little part here. Read Numbers 13, starting in verse 25 and 33. And they were returning after they've done spied out the land, and they've spied out the land for 40 days, and that's critical to kind of understanding them wandering in the desert. Starting in verse 25 of Numbers 13, it says, "And they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. Now they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back the word to them and all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told him and said, 'We went up to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey. And this is the fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan.' Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, 'Let us go up at once and take the possessions, for we are well able to overcome it.' But the men who had gone up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against these people, for they are stronger than we.' And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, 'The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and we were in their sight.'" Now we had one person stand up and say, "Yeah, let's go take that land." And again, as I was pointing out, there was 12 people chosen to go. And I wouldn't say they're the best of the best. You would think they would come back. They saw this land. And in fact, one of the previous scriptures, they brought back grapes. And they had to carry them between two men. Now, if you ever go to the grocery store, I've never seen a grapevine that my wife had to get somebody else to help carry her. Because I would imagine we would need two or three baskets to put it in. I've never seen that. So just imagining the volume of fruit there, you know. And God had also promised them to this. They were just led out of the land of Egypt. They had the fiery cloud. They've had all these other miracles. I don't know, but I think I would have been pretty confident at that time having all those signs. But then again, I wasn't there. Hindsight is always 20/20, as they say. But what were some of the challenges that we see just in these scriptures? When I look back and think about it, when they ventured out to Canaan, they weren't familiar with that land. So to me, one of the challenges was the unknown. It's kind of scary when you don't know something. You go to a different place. If you had to pack up and move to a different state that you've never been to before, I'm sure that's pretty scary. There was also the fear of war and death, because they knew they would have to conquer people if they took over this land. Now, I'm not the bravest person in the world, so I would definitely be having that in the back of my mind. If I go to war, am I going to die? And then they also said there were strong people and they were being outnumbered. And I relate that to thinking about when we go out and try to teach people, that rejection. You know, you're not always going to find someone that's meek. You're going to have people that get into your face. They're going to challenge you when you're teaching them. And so there's that fear. That's a challenge that we have. But are we going to let these challenges stand in the way of our final challenge that I'm going to talk about tonight? The final challenge is taking up the cross. This is a personal and it's a present challenge for us all, not just for me, but for everyone that is a Christian, that's a follower of God, is taking up that cross. And I'd like to read from Matthew 16, 24 through 27 on this particular challenge. Again, it's Matthew 16, starting on verse 24. It said, "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but if whomever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man will come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he will reward each accordingly to his works.'" This is our final challenge. We're not dead yet. So this challenge is still active. We don't have to go out and take the land of Canaan. I don't have to go out and, or we don't have to go out and liberate people from a land that they're held in bondage. But we do need to take up our cross. That is something that if we desire to find a home in heaven, we need to do. And all these other little challenges that we face, the fear, the unknown, speaking, teaching, even doing good works. I mean, you can do something nice for some people, but some people are really critical. And they're going to get at you and go, "Well, why are you doing that? I don't need to hear about your religion. Oh, you do that to somebody else. I don't need your pity. I don't need your kindness," or whatever, in a sense. And we're going to face that. But are we going to let those challenges of everyday life keep us from that final challenge? Keep us from finding that home in heaven? And those are the things I'm going to let you ponder as I end this. And again, this is tough to put together. But I'm hoping that it's simple, it was clear, and it was concise. That we just, when we leave here, we need to think about, what am I doing for God on a personal level? Not what am I doing for the church itself. What am I doing for Richard? What am I doing for Gene? What am I doing for CJ? What am I doing for God? Because if I'm doing this stuff for God, I'm doing it for everybody else too. So we got to keep it from, am I doing something to make myself look good? To, am I doing what God wants me to do? Am I overcoming these challenges? Now, some challenges are easier for others than they are for some. Some may not have a fear of speaking, and that's fine. But I'm sure you have a fear of something else that keeps you back. And that's the whole point of us coming together. We can strengthen one another. When we're falling short in one area, a brother can help you because they're probably stronger in that area. But yet you might be weak in another area, and then another brother can help you. So as we get ready to ponder these things, if you have fallen away through the fear of the challenges that are before you, or if you want to take up your cross and want to be converted, now is the time. Not later. Not after we're gone from here, because we're never promised anything. So as we get ready to sing the song of invitation, if you have need, please come forward now as we stand and sing.